Chapter 35. Over the Alps. In Brussels we had our first experience of culture shock. We arrived in the Belgian capital at 6 a.m, having driven there via Ghent in dull weather through flat, uninteresting countryside. After admiring the ornate, gilded facades of the town hall and other buildings in the Grand Place, and seeing the rather tawdry interior of a church that may or may not have been the cathedral, we made our way to the market. It was here that we received our culture shock. We had just bought some fine cherries and strawberries and a few vegetables, and were about to leave, when I happened to see a stall, at the back of which was a row of plucked chickens. This was not surprising. What was surprising, indeed deeply shocking, was that in front of the chickens there were rows upon rows of tiny plucked songbirds, among them, in all probability, larks that less than 24 hours earlier had been singing in the sky. There were several such stalls, all with their pathetic rows of tiny, naked victims of human barbarity and greed. This was my first intimation of the fact that songbirds were a feature of continental cuisine. Nor was this the worst. In France and Italy, as I was to discover a few years later, the shooting of small birds constituted a favourite national sport, millions of them being destroyed annually by the guns of so-called sportsmen. Even had we experienced no culture shock there, we would have felt little inclination to linger in Brussels. The city presented a somewhat shabby appearance, and having done our shopping, we drove straight out. Or rather, we attempted to drive straight out. Getting in had been easy, but owing to the complicated one-way system and poor signposting, getting out proved difficult, and it was half an hour before we found the right exit and were on our way to Namur. I navigated using the route plans Terry had obtained from the AA in London, which were both detailed and accurate, and which were to stand us in good stead throughout our journey. From Namur, we followed the course of the River Meuse to the picturesque little town of Dinan, through which we drove after crossing the historic bridge. Dinan, the name rang a bell for me, and eventually I recollected having read somewhere about a certain David of Dinan, a medieval scholastic who had narrowly escaped death for his heretical views. After Dinan came the Ardennes, under whose green eaves we were glad to stop for lunch. And after the Ardennes, the city of Luxembourg, capital of the Grand Duchy of that name. In Luxembourg, we stayed only long enough to visit the Cathedral of Notre Dame, where there are 15 or 20 people praying in the sunlit nave of the building. Their prayers were directed to the statue of the Virgin Mary, standing on the altar at the far end, and to judge from the expressions and attitudes of the supplicants, their prayers were real prayers. So real were they that I could actually see them winging their way through the air to their objective. The atmosphere of devotion was more intense than any I have experienced in a church before. From Luxembourg we drove through the Moselle Valley to Metz. We were now in France. First we saw the church of Saint Ségolène, a saint of whom I had not heard before, where a woman showed us round and where there was a quantity of fine stained glass, some of it damaged in the war. In which war it was damaged was unclear, for in the course of the last 4 or 5 centuries, Metz and its fortress had been much fought over. Originally a free town of the Holy Roman Empire, it was part of France for 200 years, part of Germany for 50, and was now again part of France. The damage to the stained glass may, of course, have been done during the Second World War. Though I did not realise it at the time, the beautiful Ardennes had been the scene of the Battle of the Bulge, when the Germans attempted to halt the eastward advance of the Allied forces, and huge losses were sustained on both sides. There was fine stained glass in the cathedral too. By the time we found ourselves standing in front of that building, however, it was evening and I was feeling extremely tired, so that I have only a vague, dreamlike recollection of our climbing the steps to the entrance of the great Gothic structure looming up in the dusk and of our cautiously opening the heavy iron door. Inside, we were at once enveloped by a mighty rolling volume of sound, which, proceeding majestically from an invisible organ, entirely filled the vast space of the deserted church, and continued to fill it, rising and falling for the greater part of our visit. Whether it was Bach or Buxtehude that was being played, or simply the organist improvising, I do not know, but the sound was the most magnificent I had ever heard, and one that transported me, despite my tiredness, to the seventh heaven of delight. We were still looking at the stained glass when a young man quietly descended from the organ loft and slipped out by a side door. Having left Metz by one of its ancient gates, we pressed on as far as Nancy, where we pulled up on the roadside and there spent the night. We had driven 320 miles that day and had not slept for 36 hours, and were now 80 miles from the Franco-Swiss border. In the morning, we drove southeast through Épinal to Remiremont, where there were many public fountains, and from Remiremont to Mulhouse, passing on the way wooded hills and picturesque villages. At the border, we stopped and bought picture postcards. I sent one to Viria, Terry one to his parents, and then drove on through Basel, and from Basel, still heading southeast, to Olten. The more direct route to Olten being blocked, we were obliged to make a wide detour. This turned out to be a blessing in disguise, for it took us, after we had been briefly caught in a hailstorm, through some exceptionally beautiful wooded ravines we would otherwise have missed. Here we halted for lunch, heating minestrone and brewing tea on our portable Calagas stove. For reasons of economy, but also because Terry tended to feel anxious in unfamiliar restaurants and cafes, we had decided that we would buy provisions along the way as we needed them, and we adhered to this decision throughout our journey. From Olten, we drove through 30 or 40 miles of beautiful countryside to Lucerne, the scenery becoming more mountainous with every turn of the road. Switzerland, we could not but notice, was much better kept than either Belgium or France, and I remembered my mother telling me that her favourite holiday destinations were Austria and Switzerland. "They were so clean," she said. But Switzerland was not only clean. It rejoiced in picturesque old wooden houses, carefully cultivated fields, and what my diary terms thoughtful arrangements for tourists. As we approached Lucerne, we had our first glimpse of the snows, and soon were inside the town walls and looking for a parking spot. Having eventually found one, we spent a couple of hours walking round the place, which obviously depended very much on the tourist trade, bought a few souvenirs, and then drove via Brunnen to Altdorf, skirting the Lake of Lucerne on the eastern side and passing through several small tunnels. A mile or two past Altdorf, we left the main road and found a pleasant spot beside the River Rius, the noise of whose fast-flowing waters we could hear in the darkness. Owing to the different nature of the terrain, as well as to our having been obliged to make a detour between Basel and Olten, we had covered only half a distance covered the day before, but we were well content with our progress and slept soundly. The third day of our journey saw us crossing the Alps. The famous mountain chain was more than a fact of geography, more than a white patch on the map. For centuries it had been a barrier separating Italy and Northern Europe psychologically as well as physically, so that crossing the Alps, far from being simply a stage in the journey south, possessed significance that was psychological and cultural and even spiritual. It was a significance of which travellers from the north were often aware, at least subliminally, an awareness of which, in modern times, the Goethe of the Italienische Reise is the prime example. Crossing the Alps meant emerging from grey skies, fog and mist into a world of blue skies, brilliant sunshine and vivid colours, emerging from numbing cold into bone-penetrating warmth. It meant leaving primeval forests of fir and oak for orange groves and olive gardens. It meant exchanging the Gothic for the classical, Christianity for paganism, religion for art, melancholy for joy. Small wonder then that poets and artists from England and Germany especially should not only have celebrated the splendour of those immaculate peaks, but have felt, as they crossed the Alps, that they were about to enter into a new world, perhaps begin a new life. What Terry and I felt as we crossed the Alps, there is now no means of telling. I have no recollection of what I myself felt then, and my diary is silent on the subject. But I must have enjoyed the unfamiliar landscape and have looked forward to seeing Italy, for in my teen years I'd had as great a love for Renaissance Italy as for classical Greece and ancient Egypt, especially after reading John Addington Symonds' Renaissance in Italy, the 7 volumes of which I borrowed from the Tooting Public Library. Silent as it is about feelings, my diary is fairly circumstantial regarding facts. In relying on those facts, however, no doubt I would do well to bear in mind what Dr. Johnson has to say in Idler, number 97, on those narratives of travellers in which, quote, "nothing is found but such general accounts as leave no distinct idea behind them, or such minute enumerations as few can read with either profit or delight." Probably there have been more than enough of these minute enumerations already in this account. Be that as it may, on the morning of the day we crossed the Alps, Terry and I rose to find the mountains flecked with snow. We also found the waters of the fast-flowing Rios icy cold. The crossing took much less time than we had expected. Hardly had we left the pleasant spot where we had passed the night than the road started becoming steeper and the scenery more and more impressive. In less than 2 hours we were at the head of the St. Gotthard Path, 6,926 feet above sea level, having driven through one where we did some shopping, and the popular mountaineering resort of Aldermatt. Both places reminded me of hill stations I had known in India. There were the same narrow streets, the same wooden houses, the same cheerful faces, and above all, the same buoyant, exhilarating atmosphere. In the course of ascent, we saw great patches of hard, unmelted snow, patches through which the road cut from time to time. The air was very thin, so that I experienced a slight nausea. The weather was cloudy, and there were several showers of rain. Rather to our surprise, traffic was heavy all the way, for at that time of year there was little danger of the road being blocked by snow, and the route was a popular one, as we ought to have known. After the St. Gotthard Pass came a succession of hairpin bends, 37 in number, that dropped us down via Airolo and Fido to Bellinzona, 761 feet above sea level, from where it was only a short drive to Lugano. In Lugano, having lunched in a quiet spot with a fine view of the lake and the mountains, we explored the shopping arcades, visited the 15th century cathedral, and looked round what I think must have been the cathedral shop, for we found a remarkable variety of modern Catholic art, some of it of a very high standard, especially the carved wooden figures of the Virgin Mary and other saints. We then continued on our way, skirting Lake Lugano for several miles, passing through the Swiss and Italian customs, where there was a short delay, and arriving in Como late in the evening. Finding a secluded spot in which to pass the night proved difficult, and in the end we simply parked at the side of the road near the lake. Como was quieter than either Lucerne or Lugano, and when we went for a walk along the shore before darkness fell, we found it deserted. The air was very still, and there was a pleasant view across the waters. That night, Terry and I had a long talk. It was our first real talk since leaving England, but regarding the content of the talk, my diary is, as usual, silent.